This is an interview with Mr. Danny Thomas on 1 August 1974, conducted by Emmett C. Schaefer at Mr. Thomas's office at 1000 hours. The subject is labor relations in the steel industry during the 30s. Mr. Thomas, how did you get started in the labor movement?
I got started in the labor movement back in 1936. While I was an employee at the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company, I worked in the mason department primarily, and I was a helper and a slag digger, cleaning out the slag out of the furnaces and rebuilding furnaces of all nature, and blast furnaces and open hearts and whatever, anything that had to do with the with brick of any heating furnaces. I worked as a youngster. I worked alongside of old-timers, and we worked like in them days what we were referred to jackasses. We had nothing to protect us. We were nothing but a number. We weren't even addressed by our full name or our first name. We were called either you Dago or you Hunky or you Black so-and-so. And my number was 11940, and they used to refer to me, check number 11940, or you Italian so-and-so. We want this done or that done. And you was at the mercy at the time of the supervision of the plant. And I knew at that time, as a youngster, that there had to be something done, that we just couldn't have stuff like this prevail. And I was seeking an organization. And I run across at the time a young coal miner who was organizing and came in from Charleroi, Pennsylvania, Huey Carcella, who is now our district director in District 7 of the United Steelworkers of America. Huey signed me up under the old hole in the wall, the old trestle, when you entered into the old entrance going into the Brahill plant. Back early in 1936. And I believe I was the number 7th man that he had recruited. And from there we started to organize and signing people up on a card to join the union. And what enthused me more was the first time I had the opportunity of meeting and hearing Philip Mary, who was our forefather and our first president of the United Steelworkers of America. I had the opportunity of meeting him personally and talking to him personally. And I knew at that time that we were on the right track of a trade union, that we had a proper teacher. He had a charisma about him that drew you to him. He had an understanding of the problems in the human being. And he sort of become an idol. I believe I loved him as second to my father. I loved him as close as I did to my dad. And I would have followed him and his teachings. And I tried to embed them in my mind of what the trade union's all about. Then came along the infamous little steel strike. Phil Mary tried to talk us out of it, out at the old Central Auditorium. He told us that we weren't ready. But being as we were in them days, and we were seeking organization, we had called the steel strike. Then started a period of misery. Now, out of the little steel strike, and out of the teachings and what I have picked up in the plants, working with older people who had more years of service and who endured a lot more obstacles and treatments than I did, this embedded into me that something had to be done and a union had to be built for our own preservation. Not because we thought we needed better wages, but because we needed better conditions and a respect. We were looking for the dignity of the man. This is why I personally got into the labor movement, for the self-preservation and the dignity of the man and the working conditions in the plant and the treatment.
What offices have you held in the labor movement?
When I was first signed up, and we had called what we in them days called lodge, local, instead of local union 1462, we were considered a lodge, 1462. From the year of 1936, I was the chairman, the first chairman of the grievance committee to handle the grievances in our plant for our lodge at that time. We later, after the convention in 1942, we later became Local Union 1462. I was the chairman of the grievance committee from the first date that we had put our lodge together, and that was in the year of 1936. From there, I became the vice president of the United of Local Union 1462 in the early part of 40. Jerry Beck was my president, Carl E. Beck, and I served as his vice president for 6 years till I was inducted into service in 1945. When I returned out of the service in 1946, I took over the helm of the local union. The local union during that interim time was put under an administrator. They had a lot of turmoil during the war at the plant gates, and Phil Murray was forced to be an administrator. When I came back, I took over the helm of the local union. I think you should be explained how this came about. I stopped in Washington and had a discussion with Mr. Murray. I told him that I was on my way out of the service, and I was heading home, but I was a heavy heart because my local union was under administrator. And he promised me, while speaking to him, that by the time I got home, the local union would receive orders that they can elect their own officers. And when I got off of the train in the city of Youngstown, and before I even went home, I went up to the local union where the nominations were at, and as I walked into the hall, I was nominated as president. I had no opposition, and I held that till the day that I went on the staff in 1960, of February the 2nd. I was the chairman of the local union in Bry Hill and participated in contract negotiations and handling all conditions for the Bry Hill plant of the Youngstown Sheen Tube Company.
What caused the turmoil at the Bry Hill Steel during the war that they had to appoint administrator?
What I was told and what had happened, the company made a change in schedule, an assignment of schedule in the Blooming Mill, and the employees were a very militant group, and they tried to get it corrected through their officials, and the company was adamant, and it brought about a work stoppage. And out of this turmoil came about the suspension of some officers in an arbitration case that was held in Youngstown.
Did the National Union put the local union under administrator?
Yeah, the International Union president, who has the powers under the Constitution, after research of the problems and the issues, so as the continuity of the contract and the benefits of the employees can continue, they have a right, after a hearing and commissions are set up, if they see fit, that they have a right to put a local union under administrator.
Was it to the benefit of the workers to appoint an administrator over having their own union?
I believe it was at that time.
Why do you say that?
Because of the conditions that were out at the time, and because there was no way that the problem could be resolved, and the people had taken the action in their own hands, and there was lines in front of the gate which was impeding the production, and there was a war on.
Was there any violence?
No, there was no violence. No violence.
Who were some of the early labor leaders that worked with you in organizing the steel plants?
We had Scotty Fagan, who had worked at the Republic. Tony Cassana, who was one of our staff representatives, who's retired now. Jerry Carly Beck. Jim Molador. Rock Greco, Fred Lamb. We had some Fred Dillard, who was my at one time a vice president under me and chairman of my blast furnace division, a militant black leader. Winchester, another gentleman. Black gentleman that was one of my former teachers about trade unionism. Gene Connolly, who run Charging Machine in the Open Heart, was one of our early presidents. Pier Master Petro, Scarpine. Pier Master Petro was our first local union president under the old Lodge of 1462. Pat Maley, who at that time was our secretary treasurer in the early days. I was just fortunate enough that I worked in and among some of the outstanding people that helped build this union. And last but not least, and not to be forgotten, was John Mayo, who was our regional director of what they referred to at that time, the Northeastern Division. We were in at the time, we were in regions instead of districts. And John L. was assigned here by John L. Lewis and Philip Mary to father the organization of the trade union movement of steelworkers in this valley. John was one of our first outstanding teachers of the trade union movement that guided us into what we are today, one of the most powerful districts in the Steelworkers Union, District 26.
Of these people you named, who do you think would be available to give an interview of this nature?
John Mayo, our former director of District 26. I would like to... you've asked that question.
Was there any... discrimination in the mills by the management over particular ethnic groups, possibly blacks?
Yes, there was it was out and out discrimination. Blacks were only hired in the coke plant and some jobs in the blast furnace. Blacks were hardly ever hired in any division where they could upgrade themselves. When they were hired In the Mason Department, they were hired as helpers and slag diggers, along with Italians, Slovaks. This is, has been one of the issues why I also became a trade unionist. I dedicated myself that the time had come that discrimination would have to cease. Now, that is not too well known because history and records are not kept. But we pride ourselves in Bry Hill that we were the first group under my leadership as president and chairman of the Greens Committee to ever penetrate the bricklayer's trade, where blacks were put on as apprentices and improvers and become bricklayers in the steel plants in this area. This come out of the Bry Hill plant. We were the first to do it and force it on the company. Back in the early days, blacks were in the washrooms, were separated. Now, I ain't talking about when integration or segregation, people didn't know how to spell it. But they were separated. They had the side for the whites, the side for the blacks. For changing clothes, the, even to the point that the bathrooms were separated, along with the bathing house, the shower room. We tried earnestly with the company to get them to dissolve this and make it into one washrooms in the different sections in the plant. They refused. So as chairman of the local union, along with Winchester and a few other loyal Stuarts and representatives, we picked up sledgehammers. And I'm talking back in the year of the early 40s. We picked up sledgehammers and we smashed down the walls that made the separation between the blacks and the whites and dared the company to fire. The company in return promised us that we wouldn't have to do it, that they'd have the labor gang go out and do it, and so came about the separation and the segregation was destroyed in Youngstown. And out of this came the pattern that was followed throughout the other portions of the sheet and tube, along with the other companies in the valley. Now, the first time that a black ever appeared on an open heart floor, Ridgway, Mr. Ridgway, we forced the company that he would be a third helper. Now, you got to remember back in these days, a black was not permitted to pick up a shovel on an open hard floor. And we forced the company that they had to bid the job. And me, and along with myself and Brother Dillard, God bless him, he's dead now, we tutored him to the position that he'd go on that floor, and if he had to drop dead in the tracks, that he'd stay and swing that shovel and slag in the furnaces and keep up with the squirrel fashion of the other slaggers to the point that he'd be respected because he was making the first inroad for any black person that was ever going to be close to an open-heart furnace that he could promote himself on up. Well, the day that they put him on the furnace, the open heart people, the supervisor who guided them, all quit working and went into the washroom. It was brought to my attention. The company said that they had a work stoppage, and I immediately appeared on the scene. They were all in the washroom with the pretense that nobody knew what it was all about. Well, at the time, it was suicide to be considered a nigger lover, and that's what you was branded in them days. But as a president and believing in what I was doing right, I stood up on the platform before them in there, and I told the company superintendent to fire every last lying son of a gun in that room, and we would replace them if they were on strike, or they were work stopping because another fellow worker was being progressing up through the regression line, regardless of his color, nationality, or origin. When they saw that I meant business, They turned around and reversed their argument and told me that the biggest problem was the incentive system. And this was what they were revolting about. Well, we got that straight in a way that we would get in their incentive system. But from that day on, in the Bry Hill plant, and eventually throughout the whole sheet and tube, we pride ourselves that we were the pioneers of breaking the discrimination barrier lines into the open art. To the tune now that our people, regardless of whom they may be, progress according to their seniority and their ability to do the job into the top paying jobs in the Youngstown Sheet Tube Company.
What year did you finally end segregation in the Bry Hill Steel?
Well, I don't know if we ended it to the position that it was ended, but it was understood and we broke up the barrier lines. This would be in the latter part or the middle part of the 40s, and strongly from the early part of the 50s.
Mr. Thomas, would you discuss in detail the little steel strike in 1937?
Let's stop that one.
Before we went to the strike, was there any segregation or discrimination within the union ranks themselves?
At the early days, it possibly were. But we were the first local union in the area. And to my recollection, anywhere as far back as I can go back and review, to have the first black officers who were on our charter as officers. We had the first recording secretary, one of the first recording secretaries of our local was a gentleman named Ted Wallace, who worked in the Mason Department, a helper alongside of me, who later became a supervisor of the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company. And incidentally, Ted Wallace was the first black man that would ever became a supervisor in the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company, to my recollection. And this came about because we had put a resolution on the floor condemning the sheet and tube companies and its policies, and we referred to it that the proof of the pudding was that there was no black man was ever a supervisor. And from that day on, thereafter, Ted Wallace was offered the job as a supervisor, and many more followed, out of the coke plant, blast furnaces, and what have you throughout the plants.
How would you discuss the strike in 37?
Well, you got to realize that I was just a youngster. In them days, I was about 21 or 22 years old. I had come out of a trade union family. My dad had worked on a railroad, and he had lost out in the big strike that they had on the railroad back in the 19s. But I believed in what I was doing. I was elected and selected or elected, picket captain on the second turn for the Bry Hill Division of the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company. I normally had, at the main gate in Bry Hill, 10 to 12 or 15 people when we had settled down to regular picketing. Prior to this, we had masses of them. And up at the Girard Gate, we always maintained 5 to 10 people on a turn. We were very vigilant in them days, and we were rugged. We were rough, but our thinking was guided by the old whispering gray-headed gentleman called Phil Merritt and his aide in Youngstown, John O'Mayo, who helped guide us through the strike to a position that it taught me a great lesson, that you can't win on picket lines when you have violence or you permit hoodlums and others to penetrate your groups that bring about dissatisfaction. Although the weapon of strike is the greatest weapon I know of man, but if it isn't used properly, it could be used against you. And this was a great teaching to me. Then when the governor of Ohio, Governor Davey, entered into the strike, and he sent in the National Guards, and then when they had the reopening of the gates, I was disillusioned. I was heartbroken, because I never dreamed that my fellow worker would return back to work. And so they penetrated at the time when we thought we lost the strike. We actually did, because they went back to work. But through the ingenuity and the guidance of Phil Mary, David McDonald, John L. Mayo, and the others, Van Bittner, the international vice president who became vice president later, we were guided into a position into the NLRB, and at the time the Wagner Act had been passed. Now, the Wagner Act at that time was just an act. It hadn't been tested in court. And we were all disillusioned that the group of us that were blackballed, that we probably were finished. Because these are the things that come out of a strike of this nature and what had happened in the past. But we have found through a new day of the Wagner Act that we had rights, and our rights at the time were infringed upon by the company. So then we had a hearings and discussions, and we entered in filing lawsuits under the Wagner Act against the company. And out of that came a decision of a settlement out of court that reinstated us back to our former positions and the job and seniority that we were entitled to. And we went and we got back into the plant, and from that day on started the rebuilding, and I believe the building of the what we call the United Steelworkers and what we would consider at that time the Little Steel Strike Group. And that had a big thing to do about organizing, because I know I became that much more dedicated, and I made it my business to talk to and influence everybody within any hearing that I could get to them. Join a union, either in my local, I participated in other places throughout the valley of organizing for the United Steelworkers. But in them days, we were the Steelworkers Organizing Committee. We became the United Steelworkers later on the Constitutional Convention. I want everybody to know that a steel strike is, or any type of a strike, is not a picnic. I probably was more fortunate than my father at the time, who was working at the Republic, and other gentlemen who had families. For the little bit of help that was given out at the time, and God bless the mine workers, the food lines that they had set up, I would turn my portion down because I was staying at home and my dad was working at the Republic and he was picking up his portion there of some food. So I didn't receive mine because I would turn it down so somebody else could have it. But as time went on, everybody returned to work. There was a group of us that were blackballed, even to the position that I couldn't secure any position of work anywhere. No one would give us a job, credit, nothing. We were just let out to a position that we were sort of lost. I wound up eventually penny dancing on a railroad in Barbington, Ohio, for the Pennsylvania Railroad. I lasted there until they found out who I was for a week or two, and then I was out of work again. Now, I just struggled along, and being that I was single, it wasn't too much of a burden, although it was, and I can visualize what happened to married people. Scotty Fagan, who worked at the Republic, was in a position that he could never pay his rent, and every time he moved into someplace, when the month due his rent, There was rent was due on the month. We all banded together and moved Scotty again. One time, I believe we moved them three times in 4 months, because the one landlord had already found out he couldn't pay the rent. This was some of the things that we had to go through. But I believe it was well worth it to bring about the birth of the United Steelworkers.
Was there any violence at Briar Hill?
Minor violence. We did not have any mass hurting or that. Yes, the sheriff, at that time, Sheriff Elser, and a back-to-work movement that was started by the company, formulated among thugs, people who had just got out of prison or who had records. They penetrated into our lines, and they tried to create a hysteria and problems, and we refused to fall for it. We singled them out, and many times, yes, we had some violence of eliminating this type of people out of our line so there wouldn't be any violence on the bigger line. No, we didn't get much in the Briar Hill plant. There was nothing in the sheet and tube portion of the violence. But there was at the Republic. The night that we were being addressed by Mrs. Jasher, a national committee woman of the Democrat Party, we were standing there, and then the Republic police, along with the, at that time, Elser's, what we used to call Elser's cowboys, thugs and that he recruited to help break up the strike, opened up a tear gas, and it brought about a catastrophe in the Republic. Now, there's people at work down there, although I was in the vicinity. I think you'd be better off discussing that with a guy named Jerry Beck, Tommy White, and the likes of them people, because they were right there at the front line.
Who were the major adversaries of the strike employed by the company?
During the 37th steel strike, while acting as picket, on second turn, a report came in explaining that there was people working up at the scrap pile on the north end of the plant toward the Girard Gate. We got in the cars and went up and made a scant review by eye, and we saw that there was activities in among the scrap that was piled in that area, and they were loading scrap on cars. As a picket captain, I had a discussion with our pickets. We said, okay, we'll take a trip through the Erie Railroad properties, cross over and go into the plant, and if there was anybody that we knew that was doing any work there, we'd influence them to quit working and get out of there. And this we did. When we got in there, there was five individuals working, two separate cranes loading scrap. Mind you, this is after the strike had been on for a month or two. So we turned around, got them out of the plant. While we were seeking one more person, the sheet and tube police come in armed, and there was five of us that was held at bay by gun. The rest had left. We were taken down into the headquarters of the Briar Hill plant in front of the superintendent and discussed the problem of what was happening. I acting as a spokesman, explained to him that we had told him that stuff was being done. They had agreed that we'd have a peaceful strike, but they were undermining it, and they wouldn't do nothing about it. They worked the ore bridge when we had told them not to work it, and there was other incidents that they'd done, and they refused to live up to a peaceful strike. And this is the reason why we took it in our own hands at the time to put a stoppage to it. He guaranteed me that this would never happen again, would never be used on our records, that we were still workers of the sheen tube when it was all over, not to worry about it. Well, that time, a mass of strikers had massed out the gate. Word had got out that the sheen tube was working over some strikers. They were beating them up, and the word had went out. And workers came in with pickaxes, hoes, and what have you from their fields and their homes. And there was a yelling crowd at the old hole in the wall. But after Mr. Carcella explained everything to everybody, there was peacefulness again, and we all dispersed back into our homes. These are the kind of minor incidents that happened during the steel strike.
Who was the superintendent, do you recall?
The open heart superintendent was Tom Cleary. Turned foreman at that time was a guy we called Tom Reardon. Now, Reardon we always referred to as Peanuts Reardon. He is dead now. But Reardon, while a first helper during the 37th strike, was a member of our union, signed a card, and was in good standing until he became a turn foreman, went on to become supervision later on. And he was one of the pioneers in the open heart, along with Gene Collin and others that helped organize the open heart in the Brahill plant.
This is the end of side one of tape one on this interview. Communist influence in the steel strike in
37? Yes, I don't believe there was influence, but there was some commies that I found out later that were in the steel strike in 1937. Now you have to remember that I was a lad of around 20, 21 years old, and I had been out of school and had participated working in a plant. I had always thought when I was in school that anybody can become president. I didn't know anything about discrimination until I went into the plant and found out what was going on. And I knew nothing about isms. This is why I say that I've been thankful that I had some super teachers that guided me properly. In them days, it was very easy to get a militant person like myself and have a smart, intelligent communist leader boost him along to the position that he could sway his thinking. Because in my thoughts in them days is I would do anything to organize and bring about the dignity of the individual, because of the treatments that we received in the plants. Yes, I know Gus Hall. Gus Hall organized up through this area. I know him when I was a youngster. I've heard him speak. He never influenced me too much. I never knew at the time when I first met him that he was a commie or a member of the commie party. But I knew him, and I saw others. But I was well schooled, as I told you, by John Mayo, Carcella, and others. And I got to understand by talking with Jerry Beck, and he handed me different books to read. I began to understand that there is isms, and there was isms in this country. And I got to the point where I could almost pinpoint, through the years of experience, by a person's discussions and expressions, I can almost pinpoint what ism he belongs to. This is an education you learn in the trade union movement. And Gus Hall caused us a lot of turmoil during the little steel strike by bringing about walkouts and other plants that we had organized that had nothing to do with the steel strike and dissolved the relationship that we had in these companies. One of them was the old Van Huffel Company. We had a good contract in there and a working agreement. During that time, Gus Hall pulled them out on strike on sympathy, although it didn't help the cause at all. Wound up that Mr. Van Huffel dropped the contract, and from that day on, he said there would never be another agreement there as long as he lived, and he made them words stick. And we finally, years later, organized them back into the steelworkers. These are some of the things that went about during them days of the isms. Yes, there was some isms. Communism, or whatever you want to call it, back in the early days of 36 and 37.
In 37, what was the ratio of union members as opposed to the total employees in this Briar Hill tube plant?
Well, you have to realize we had a voluntary dues-paying plan at the time. $1 a month. It all depends of the militancy of the officers. We had to keep following the members around in different beer gardens or other places where they go for a sandwich or a drink to make sure that they had their dues paid, and especially on payday. Now, according to the militancy of the officers and the people who had some reflection of how it is to build an organization and it takes finances, this told you how great your membership was. I don't mind telling you at many times it was at a very low ebb because there wasn't inconsistency in dues paying. It was just as fast as you caught them to pay their dues. People would only make sure that their dues were paid in them days when they were in a possibility of a little trouble with the company. But and when they got themselves relieved of the problem, they forgot their dues. And many times we were at 50%, sometimes at 25% of the people. In them days, we had a membership in Briar Hill, a total membership, potential membership of 3,100 people or better. And if we ever had $1,000 a month dues for 1,000 members, we thought that was almost 100%. I'll state it. The truth is the truth.
Who were the groups or individuals in Youngstown that were against the strike?
Well, there was numerous. We found ourselves in many ways where we thought we had friends, we found we had enemies. You got to remember that the steel companies have always been the dominant factor in this valley. They were what they call the power structure. Whatever they said went, even to the point that they controlled the thinking of the churches. I don't mind telling you, and it's a matter of history, all you have to do is go back and pick up the Vindicator. On the front page of the Vindicator, there appeared one time an editorial written by the Knights of Columbus, of the Catholic organization of which I've been a part of and was raised in. Even to the point that I started getting disillusioned that my church was against me. The Vindicator, which was a powerful rag at the time, a powerful newspaper. Mogg, who was a big controlling factor of the thinking of the people in his valley, run constant stories against us. Then we had a sheriff who was a political bigot who belonged to the powers. Although he was a Democrat, who hired thugs and some mobsters as private detectives and sheriffs and deputies to come in among us and create us problems. They imported weapons, bombs, and what have you, and they had them all set through the plants with machine guns mounted, threatening in case something would happen, they could have killed thousands of us. Beside that, we had the chief of police against us. We had the city prosecutor, R.J. Thomas. Ray Thomas, he was known as, no relation, who was the spokesman behind the scenes setting up to back to work and break in the strike efforts of the steelworkers. We had a ring of steel that we had to fight and a powerful chain that they had rung around us. But we come out of it and we surmounted to the point today that we're a well-respected organization. And I'm proud to be a member of it.
The steel strike was broken in 37 and you finally received a contract in 42. Could you discuss the main reason why the companies all of a sudden decided to negotiate, sign a maintenance of agreement contract during those 5 years?
Well, as I told you, it was an act pass to the influence of the mine workers, John L. Lewis leadership, and Phil Mary, to the President of the United States, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, called the Wagner Act, giving you, giving the employees of this nation the right to belong to a union of their own choice. At the early days, no one knew what this meant until the little steel strike. And then it was tested in court, and the Supreme Court ruled that the Wagner Act was constitutional, and thereafter became negotiating with the small steel companies agreements of settlement to return back to work and give the rights to the employees. And in the year of 1941, a document was completed that gave us our reinstatement. And the company agreed to destroy all company union activities and to recognize the Steelworkers Organizing Committee as a bargaining agent. We received our first contract in the year of 1942 on August the 13th with the Youngstown Sheen Tube Company.
Phil Murray's personality influence steel management and signing strike, if so, in what way?
Yes, Phil Murray had a charisma in his personality and what he stood for that even his enemies admired him. The proof of the pudding was that the United States Steel Company at the time recognized the Steelworkers Organized Committee as a bargaining agent, and they signed an agreement on March the 17th, 1937, that became historical agreement. And Phil Murray, I believe, had more to do of getting a peaceful settlement with U.S. Steel than any other human being, because Ben Fearless at that time, the president of the company, and later made many statements where he admired Phil Murray and his ability and his statesmanship. Yes, I got to say that Phil Murray was our father of this organization, and he's always been looked upon as our leader and the instrument that helped build it. Did
has the steel industry ever tried to control the labor market in Mahoning Valley?
Yes, the steel industry did try, and it did control it. You have to go back now 30-some years, and you have to go back and check the history of the industry in this valley. Now, you must remember that the Mahoning Valley, what we call the River Valley, that starts in Pittsburgh and ends up in Gary, Indiana, and Chicago. In this valley lies some of the outstanding skills of the world, workers, semi-skilled workers, skilled workers, all type, engineers and what have you. Some of the best brains in the world lie here. But take a look at our valley in Mahoning Valley, where I can speak of, and research your history. The steel industry kept industry from coming in this valley. Other groups that would want to move into the valley were not received too friendly. They controlled the powers at the time of the administrations that were in offices in the city or in the county. And whoever tried to penetrate in this valley to participate into the labor market were given a cold shoulder. It was been quite some time that this thing has finally been broken. And I would say that in the last 10 or 15 years, through the instrument of organized labor, and because of the powers that are being shifted somewhat, yes, we've penetrated it now. We have what we call diversified industry moving into our valley. This has hurt us for many, many years, but it's now coming to our benefit.
What has been the major accomplishments of the steel labor movement in Youngstown?
The major basic compliments that have been penetrated or by the steel movement, or the steel workers union, or the labor movement, I have to state to you that is to give the working man a place in the sun. It brought about the dignity of the person. It brought about respect and understanding. It gave him a right to discuss and participate in his place of work. Not only did it make him the highest paid skilled and semi-skilled worker in the world, but it changed the whole lifeline conditions. If you participated in a steel plant back in the days when we did, you thought you worked in a mean jungle of animals and wild savages. Today, it has changed because of the participation of the union. The work tables are different. Everything is under consideration a lot different than what it was. And the benefits that it was given to the children of the workers, their educational systems, it changed the political structure in the city of Youngstown and the cities in the valley. At one time in Trumbull County, I recall when I was a youngster, it was the hub and home of the Ku Klux Klan. Organized labor brought about better understanding and broke most of this thinking up to today. All types of groups are recognized in politics and what have you. This is organized labor, and I've been proud to be a part of it.
What is your reaction, Thomas, to the statement that American labor is producing less, resulting in higher prices?
I'm not an economist. I'm not too well swayed by slogans or statements by individuals. I do not think that the statement is fair. I don't believe that it is a true statement. I know, and everybody in this land knows, that organized labor is the highest producing element in the world. All you have to do is judge it against other countries. In its participation in work, and where we have organized plants, the quality of production is increased in the quantity. Now, if it's being blamed and all the time becomes a whipping dog is organized labor because of cost of living, what have you. This is the old trick. The hogs on the top steal everything and then blame the bottom that they're causing it. Now, organized labor or the working man does not set the prices. The prices are set by the corporations or by the industries or the companies. And their profits are set to such a way that it puts us in a dilemma all the time of trying to catch up. All we keep doing in organized labor, as far as I see it, is trying to reach for the bone constantly that they keep raising higher and higher. Well, the day is going to come of understanding where good heads are going to be settling this thing, and I don't think that the steel or the labor groups will be recognized people as created. I think the American people are too brilliant and too smart to be kidded by that fact.
Danny, what has been the major changes in the procedures of organizing and negotiating in the early days in 1937 as opposed to organizing and negotiating today in 1974?
There has been tremendous change, tremendous change. In the early days, under the old Steelworkers Organizing Committee, we were organizing. As I explained to you at the beginning in some of this talks, we were crude, rough. All we believed in is social justice, and we demanded it one way or the other. And we did it by showing our strength and flexing our muscles, organizing ourselves that we were always ready to bring about cease of work if we had to. Now, as time went on, and the union and the company bargained into agreements, the closer understanding is becoming between them. No more does the people on one side consider the company with the briefcases are looked upon as intelligent and the respected people of the community, and this is how it used to be. Now, briefcases are on both sides. And the people on the labor side, in many instances, are a lot brighter and smarter, economically wise and negotiable-wise and understanding. Do you realize that if I start into a contract negotiations now, today, with a company, all I have to do is call or write a letter to the Research Department of the United Steelworkers of America in Pittsburgh. I will receive a concise and complete summation of that company, of its profits, of what it's worth, of how it's guiding and where it's heading. I will know more about that company than many times than the people that are sitting across from me who are subordinates of the officials of the company who they send in to negotiate. And many times I will give them the report so they'll know what they're talking about because they can't receive it. So once you're put into this category, you understand the problem. You know the financial picture, and you'll be able to guide your committee and your membership that you're privileged to represent to an understanding of what you can do and can't do, what would be good or what would be bad, what good is it to get a contract and then can't get it administered because the company's out of business. This is why today it's a lot different. We are more on an even keel. And as I said, sometimes beyond the knowledge of the people that we're supposed to be combating with on agreements.
As a young man, what was your reaction to the Depression in 1932?
Well, now we're talking about some years gone by. This is 1974. You're talking about 1932, now you're talking about 40-some years. Yes, I was what they call a depression baby, young fella. It was a hardship. Dad was not working. Nothing was coming in, but we survived. A little WPA, a little CWA, and what have you. We moved into the country. We thought possibly we could toil into the soil. We found that we lost money there. I had to leave school. I couldn't further my education in high school because of the conditions. I went to school up to the second grade in high school. I did return later to go to Youngstown College and take a couple of courses in economics through the guidance and the help of Dean Smith, a wonderful gentleman who was a good friend of mine. It was horrible to see people standing in lines, trying to eke out a little bit of food to take home to their families. I hope that this condition will never again blight our nation. But I'll say one thing for it. It taught us how to unite and help each other. In the days of the Depression, it wasn't everybody trying to live like the Joneses. In the days of the Depression, all the Joneses were living together. We helped each other. Whoever had something would divide it amongst each other in the neighborhood. If somebody was sick, the neighbor was sick, Mom made sure that there was something done for the family, or vice versa. There was a good human understanding. Maybe these kind of catastrophes bring about like the year of the big snow in the 50s. But I wouldn't want to wish it on anybody. There was a lot of people deprived and a lot of children deprived of the rightful food in life. And I think the answer to that is take a look at our generation of what we call during the Depression, and then take a look at the generation of my children and grandchildren. There's a vast difference in their knowledge and their structure and their everything in every way life. I wouldn't want to bless this on nobody.
You think the younger generation would accept the Depression today?
No. I don't think that this country can stand a depression. I don't think that the knowledge that the younger generations and the understanding and what they've learned and their schooling ability. The younger generation know the answers of these things. They know what brings them about. They know that depressions are man-made, misguidance of officials in capacity of high offices. There should never be a depression. There is no call for a depression. And if it does come about, I don't think that the next generation will permit them to do what they did to us back in the Depression of 32. I don't think they'll never put these kids on the picket lines to go out and beg money or something to eat. I don't think this will ever come about. This is why I'm sure that this country of ours has a cushion of something on compensation and what have you to get us over the blight years on some recessions. No, I got to answer it. I don't think the young generation would take it.
May the Youngstown State University Oral History Department use this recording in their research program?
Yes, you can. And if the Youngstown State would want some more information and not where I have more time, I'd be more than willing to grant it or go down and give it to them formally in person.
I have an agreement for you to sign. Bibliography sketch. This is the end of the interview with Mr. Dan Thomas, who is still active in the labor movement as a staff representative in District 26.
Subdirector.
I am.
corrected, sub-director of District 26. And Mr. Danny Thomas is how old?
59
years old. This is the end of the interview.